Welcome to this Texas Water Symposium. We are pleased to have you here tonight. I see faces of veterans of this particular program because it is a program that goes back to 2007. Remember, we got started doing that and thought, let's do three symposia this year and we'll have everybody knowing everything about water. And somehow we didn't get through everything that first year. And there was a second, third, fourth, and on. And the programs have continued to be of a value. My name is Tim Summerlin, president here at Shriner University. We have been pleased to be partners with Texas Tech University, Texas Public Radio, and the Hill Country Alliance in the production of these symposia on water-related issues. This program is at Shriner University this evening. It is located, the symposia have been in Junction, Fredericksburg, San Antonio, Austin on one occasion, and have been very well attended and I think very much appreciated. On Shriner's campus, the program is under the auspices of the Nell Shriner Labatt Series, which is a series of lectures and discussions for the community as well as for the campus. Tonight's topic is a very modest one. If you picked up a program, you would have seen that the program is titled Healthy Watersheds, Fracking and the Energy Water Nexus, a look at every angle and every question surrounding this timely topic. To my panel, I would say that doesn't impose any particular burden on you, I'm sure, because you all understand every angle and every problem. We're very fortunate that that is the case, but we will be wide-ranging in our discussions this evening. I want to thank another person besides the panel, whom I will introduce in just a moment, and that's Dr. Tom Arsufi, who is here, director of the Llano River Field Station, Texas Tech University Junction. Tom has been a part of this series from the beginning and always is full of good ideas and is a good prompt to get the rest of us together sometimes when we're not as organized as we ought to be. We're happy to have you here this evening, Tom. Now, I told you a moment ago who I was and my job, and you may well ask, oh, good, you're a geologist. I had no idea. No, actually, my qualifications for being the moderator this evening are really the vast amount of curiosity and ignorance that I bring to the topic. There may be some of you in the audience who share some of those traits as well. But still, I am pleased to be the moderator. I'm going to introduce to you briefly each of our participants and then let them go at it. Now, our panelists, we're very pleased to have here, and we have Dr. Ken Rainwater, earned his PhD in civil engineering from UT in Austin. He is the director for the Texas Tech University Water Resources Center. He's done that for the last decade. And Dr. Rainwater will basically talk about kind of the what and the why. What is this process? What are its uses? What is the significance of fracking in the whole energy enterprise? And then second, Leslie Savage, who is chief geologist for the Oil and Gas Division of the Railroad Commission of Texas, will be speaking. Her work there includes coordinating rulemaking for the division, coordinating with federal and other state agencies, and water quality certification of federal permits. And she also took her a geology degree from the University of Texas. And then her topic will be, her focus will be on the magnitude of fracking in the state of Texas, some particulars about its benefits and uses, and some questions of how it's regulated. And then third, Dr. Cyrus Reed, who is for the Lone Star chapter of the Sierra Club, the conservation director. He has his doctorate from the University of Texas. We've got a hat trick there in geography and the environment. He's also has served as the director of the Texas Center for Policy Studies. Dr. Reed will talk about environmental issues, concerns about possible needs for further regulation. So that's the pattern that we will be following this evening again, and then question and answer opportunities at the end. So I will now turn this over to Dr. Ken Rainwater and let him begin.
Thank you very much. It's always good to be on the radio because you don't have to worry about that makeup stuff, right? We're all good. I do appreciate being invited to be here. It's always a pleasure to drive from Lubbock in this time of year when the ground is bare to the hill country where it looks like it rained and things look green and the flowers are good. So we appreciate that, especially after last year. So that's important to us. You can go ahead and laugh about my name. My name is Ken Rainwater, and I do water stuff. We can just get that over with. I really come from a long line of auto mechanics, and I was the most klutzy one, and so that's why I was sent another direction. But most of my jobs dealt with grease and brooms. But I did grow up in the Permian Basin, which is a big oil patch in West Texas, and I've seen drill rigs and come and go over time, and a lot of activity is happening now. Recently, we drove from Lubbock to visit my mother over the Christmas holidays. And as we drove north of Midland and Odessa, we didn't need our headlights at night because there's so many rigs out there operating in terms of normal work as well as the application of this process. So it's something we want to recognize as in terms of its opportunities and also its responsibilities. One of the things, if you just watch TV and movies and maybe the internet, I don't know, people might have the idea that when oil comes out of the ground, it comes up, we have a gusher. Yeah, we all remember seeing things like that, you know, in the movies. I see some people that might be my age here as well. The opening frames of the Beverly Hillbillies show, is that coming to mind? Jed was shooting at some food, and up from the ground comes some bubbling crude. I wish I could get that theme song out of my mind, but it's stuck there with Gilligan's Island and a few other things that prevent me from learning more stuff. But people tend to think, perhaps, based on some of our representations, that oil freely flows out of the ground if we just give it a way to do that. And there have been places where that would happen, where the pressure was high enough for that to happen on its own. But essentially, we have, in most places in the world, we tend to produce the easy oil and gas first from the wells, and then later we have to go back to see when it's worth it to produce what's left. Listening to my friends in the Petroleum Engineering Department at Texas Tech speak, typically when we deal with an oil reservoir and a gas reservoir, we're lucky to get a third of the stuff out of it in the normal procedures. And then we go to secondary and tertiary recovery methods to try to increase the amount of oil and gas that we can get out. And so fracturing is one of the processes that was born several decades ago to help with that process. Now, first off, whenever we do drill oil wells, I guess, and gas wells, historically, primarily they were vertical. That's where we started. So that means you go start at the surface, you go through whatever is between you and the oil and gas till you get to the oil and gas so you can try to produce it. In many parts of our state, nearer the surface, we have a water-bearing stratum that we call an aquifer. And that has been known for as long as they've been drilling wells, and we also recognize that that water is a potential drinking water source. So for many years, there have been rules that the oil companies have to, and the producers have to, drillers and producers have to live by, where they drill, as they drill through the aquifer, they have to establish what's called a surface casing that goes all the way through the aquifer and some distance below it, typically 100 feet or so, that is a solid pipe. Casing is the word we use, not like a sausage casing. I want you to think of something more solid than that. We are in Central Texas, right? So it is a steel pipe. And then that's also surrounded with high-pressure cement that makes sure, if it's done right, that the water from the aquifer will not leak down the hole further into the whatever happens beneath, and also so that stuff that goes through the vertical part of the well, through the aquifer, doesn't get out. And that process has been followed for several decades and is required and documented and regulated for all oil and gas drilling. Then, of course, they drill down into the oil and gas producing zone and try to get the material out that way. In the old days, the wells were just vertical, but there, in some cases, after producing the oil and gas, they knew there was still some out in the formation that through geophysical or other means, and they wanted to increase the flow, the chance of more flow to the producing well. And so the concept of fracturing was born to use the injection of fluids under pressure, water, in combination with other chemicals, to try to push it out into the formation and try to essentially cause fractures, cause cracks within it. So they might not really very large. The fractures were caused by the injection of the chemicals and the water. You might have heard of acidizing, things like that, in different types of formations. And then there could be some sand or some silica beads that were also injected to help hold those fractures open to make it easier for the oil and gas to flow. So that's been going on for a number of decades. We've all lived long enough now that the drilling companies have the ability to drill wells at other angles than vertical. And so once they get into a producing zone, a play, I guess as we call it, then they can turn the well so they go horizontally and fan out into the formation and then use the same processes there. You can imagine that it's probably a lot more expensive to drill a well that has horizontal directional components to it than it was for the vertical one. So there are significant costs associated with that. The same concepts about fracturing are applied through these horizontal wells as well, so that the injection of different types of water and chemical combinations can be used to cause the fracturing, and then that proppant is used to help hold the fractures open. That process has been around for a good long time. We're hearing a lot more about it because technology has recently moved such that it's easier to apply, perhaps, than it used to be, and the incentive might be the price of oil is high. A few years ago, when fracking started to flourish, it was when the price of gas was high. So, and I believe Ms. Savage will have a lot to say about that from the industrial side because of her familiarity with that. So she will do a much better job than I'm doing with that issue. That's kind of a general overview of what the process is. One of the reasons it's important to us as a country is this, I guess you noticed the commercials on TV. If you watched the March Madness, there were a lot of commercials about hydraulic fracturing during that, implying that this allows us to produce more oil here in our country than the oil we import from other places. And so there are some advantages to that in terms of where the oil comes from, how much do you pay to transport it versus what it costs to drill for it. That is an important part of the issue. Now, another thing that people get concerned about is the relative position of where the fracturing is taking place, especially with these horizontal wells, compared to where our aquifers that we get our drinking water from. How are they related to each other? And typically, our aquifers are shallow. They're usually less than 1,000 feet from the surface in much of the state of Texas, sometimes maybe 2,000 to the bottom, depending upon where you are. The fracturing that takes place beneath those aquifers is typically on the order of thousands of feet further below in completely different geologic material with other materials in between, hopefully that will cause a buffer zone such that what's happening in the fracture zone doesn't interact with the aquifer above, because nobody wants to make that happen on purpose. Now, there have been some claims of some issues of contamination in some places, and there are some studies going on with the EPA and others, and there are some lawsuits that are happening in some places with investigations going on as people try to determine when contamination problems might have happened. Again, typically where these are applied, the fracturing with the horizontal wells is very deep. The aquifers are relatively shallow. We still have we always have that concern about the vertical part of the well that goes through the aquifer, and which I described with the casing and the cementing process to help protect it. I guess I'll defer to Leslie in terms of the discussion of the other incentives that have caused the increase in the application of this technology across our state and elsewhere. So thank you.
I'm Leslie Savage. Just wanted to mention to Dr. Summerlin that with me, I feel honored. I'm the only non-PhD up here. So I'm sure that I have a sufficiency of ignorance on many issues. So I want to thank you for having me here. I am Leslie Savage. I've been with the Railroad Commission Oil and Gas Division for over 28 years now. I began when I was 10. that still makes me kind of old. I have to find another story. I'm going to talk a little bit today about the magnitude in Texas, the impact that this oil and gas shale exploration has had on Texas, some of the benefits, and then I'm going to touch on a few of the issues that we have either had to deal with or we are currently dealing with at the Railroad Commission. I don't know if everybody knows, Texas is the number one oil and gas producer for a couple of years. We were going back and forth with Alaska, but I think we have definitely exceeded their production in oil and gas. In Texas, it's estimated that over 1 million holes have been drilled for oil and gas over the history. And this is since like the late 1890s. There are currently 400,000 wells in the state of Texas, and that's producing wells and wells that potentially could produce that are not yet plugged. Basically, these wells in 2011 produced enough crude oil to produce 7.7 billion gallons of gasoline. Now, at almost $4 a gallon, calculate that. It's a lot of money. They also produced enough natural gas to meet the needs of over 7 million homes for 15 years. That's 7 trillion cubic feet of natural gas in 1 year, 2011. And for gas, that was kind of a low year since the oil and gas industry has been a victim of their success. When hydraulic fracturing in the Barnett Shale began several years ago, the price of natural gas was over $7 a cubic feet, cubic foot. It's now close to three. I think it's two. Okay, so it's gone down even more. That's a lot of natural gas, given that the production of natural gas has gone down in the state of Texas. In Texas, there are almost 50% of all the working oil and gas rigs here in Texas. 30% of those rigs are in the Eagle Ford area right now. One of the reasons for that is because the Eagle Ford also has areas that produces crude oil. And obviously the crude oil is high, the natural gas prices are low, so they're going to drill where the crude oil is. There were 7,500 oil and gas wells that were drilled last year, and that number is down from 2009. 2009 was the high on the number of wells that were drilled, number of permits that were issued by the Railroad Commission. So those are big numbers in anybody's book. You've probably all heard about the big shale plays here in Texas. We have the Barnett Shale, which really started it out. We have the Eagle Ford. We have the Haynesville, which straddles the Texas-Louisiana line. And we have a whole bunch of other relatively large plays for oil in West Texas. Everybody's heard about the Marcellus in the Northeast. That is in an area where their oil and gas production, either they have never had oil and gas production, no drilling in their history, or the production is very, very old and relatively innocuous before this. So it's a huge issue. It's also in urban areas where it wasn't before. People have spread out in suburbs. And I don't know about you, but I didn't even know when I bought my first house whether or not I owned the mineral rights. I don't. So someone theoretically could come. Somebody else owns my mineral rights, the mineral rights below me. So there are a lot of issues. Economic benefit for Texas are very big. Last year, oil and gas producers paid $2.6 billion in oil and gas severance tax alone. And that does not include, we're on track to pay, to receive almost double that this year. So that's good since we're running at a state deficit, and that's always been a problem, and we have a legislative session coming up. And that amount does not include economic benefits from, for example, sales tax, royalties that are paid to royalty owners, to the mineral interest owners, wages from relatively high-paying jobs, and other benefits. And the benefits are not just on a state level. They're also on a local level. For example, in the Eagle Ford Shale, which is in the southern part of the state, Dimmitt County is one of those states, and their annual sales revenue increased more than 1,000% from 2009 to 2011. They were getting a couple of tens of thousands of dollars, and they're getting over $1 million now. So it has a huge impact on local government and local economy as well. The increase in oil and gas activity that was made possible by combining relatively old, well, hydraulic fracturing is relatively old technology. It's been done for over 60 years. Now, the high volume water fracs have not been done for 60 years. That's a relatively new twist on this old technology. But then also combining that with horizontal drilling and drilling in a shale, which we've never been able to produce before because the gas, it just won't release the gas without some encouragement, and that's what the hydraulic fracturing is. That increase in activity has brought all these benefits, but the sheer magnitude of this increase brings with it also problems. And there's some issues that we've been having to deal with, such as waste, spills, increased volumes of produced water and fractured flowback water, traffic, dust, people moving into areas that were rural and relatively unpopulated and just kind of hoarding in on it because that's where the drilling's going on. Not enough housing, not enough water, not enough apartments, things like that. Those are all issues. Obviously, the Railroad Commission doesn't regulate or deal with all of those issues, but they're issues still that people are having to face. What I talk about a little bit, though, are issues that the Railroad Commission has faced and issues that have become issues through the media. And some of this is my opinion, just 28 years at the Railroad Commission. We at the Railroad Commission were not prepared for this huge influx of permit applications, drilling activity, need for enforcement, need for inspectors. All of this peak came at a time when state agencies were under hiring freezes. We were losing people to retirement. And I'm the old lady at the commission now. You know, most everybody else that came up with me are retired. We lost an awful lot of institutional knowledge, historical knowledge, why we did what we're doing now. We also had a budget cut around 10 to 15%. I think it ended up being 10%. And then also industry can pay a lot more than the state can. They pay four times more than we do, so we've been losing not only people who have a lot of years and a lot of experience, but we have a lot of trouble hiring. So we were kind of caught in a quandary. We couldn't hire people, we couldn't keep people on, and yet the activity was exploding across the state. And then there was the media attention. There are some issues in the media, in my opinion, that are true issues. There are other issues that are being brought up by media that I don't think are that big an issue in Texas. One thing I do want to mention, when someone says fracking, and I try not to say that, I try to say hydraulic fracturing. My grandmother always made me put a dime, I guess it'd be $2 now, in a mason jar whenever I said a dirty word. And so I owe two bucks now to my charity jar. But whenever someone says hydraulic fracking, number one, it's used as a dirty word in a lot of instances. And number two, it's used to encompass everything that might be associated with not only hydraulic fracturing techniques, but the drilling, the waste management, the underground injection, the noise, the air emissions, everything. It's used as kind of a universal term. So when I say hydraulic fracturing, what I'm talking about is the actual hydraulic fracturing technique itself. But I understand that when people say fracking, I'm up to $6, when people say fracking, that they mean everything. And so it helps to understand, to use the same language. There are currently right now over 12 studies that are being performed by federal agencies. This includes studies by EPA, studies by the Department of Energy, study by the Department of the Interior for federal lands, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the General Accountability Office, and the U.S. Geological Society. There are numerous universities also and colleges across the state and across the nation that are performing studies on all of these issues. Actually, there are three committees of the Texas Legislature who have interim charges and are holding interim hearings this summer on issues associated with oil and gas and hydraulic fracturing, including the water energy nexus, safety, casing and cementing of wells, and air and other issues. One of the studies that I mentioned before is the Department of Energy study, and their preliminary report basically said this. groundwater risks are unlikely to result from the hydraulic fracturing process itself. But it notes that there are still serious environmental impacts underlying concerns about gas shale development that need to be prevented, reduced, and where possible, eliminated. The report specifically mentioned poor well construction that includes the casing and the cementing that Ken mentioned, cumulative impacts, and the hydraulic fracturing chemical disclosure issues, the chemicals that are used. We agree. There are some issues. However, currently in Texas, there are no documented cases of groundwater contamination as a result of actual hydraulic fracturing. There are, in some other states, incidents that have been tied to poor well construction. Having said that, I want to say that there are incidents that usually that can happen in any oil and gas activity, and because of the magnitude of this activity right now and over the past years, those incidents tend to increase. When you have a lot more activity, the bad things increase too, as well as the good things. There are some issues that we're dealing with and that we have dealt with. Chemical disclosure is one. Induced seismicity or earthquakes that you may have all heard about. Earthquake at the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport, one in Oklahoma, Arkansas has had a couple. The scientists, at least everything that I have read about, the scientists are saying that they do not think that there is a connection to the actual hydraulic fracturing. Number one, that occurs very deep, and the fractures are actually the thickness of a hair, basically, or maybe a little bit larger. But there is some evidence, and that evidence is being studied right now by, we're working with the Environmental Protection Agency and other states, as well as the U.S. Geological Society, to determine if maybe these earthquakes could have been triggered by injection or disposal of the large volumes of fractured flowback water and produced water. So there are studies ongoing, and the scientists at this point, from what I read, are split. The studies haven't been concluded. So at this point, it is a theory. Last year, the Texas legislature passed and the Railroad Commission implemented a rule that requires all oil and gas operators who perform hydraulic fracturing on wells, including oil and gas wells, in the state of Texas, disclose the chemical ingredients that they use. Now, the law and the rule allows for, it recognizes that the Texas Government Code Public Information Act allows for trade secret protection. In other words, there's a business advantage to keeping some of that information secret. And the Texas law allows for that, not only for oil and gas, but for a lot of other things. But it does, both the law and the rule allows for a challenge to that. So if I'm a landowner or an adjacent landowner, and I want to know what those secret chemicals are, the proprietary chemicals are, I can challenge that. And then it goes to the Attorney General's office, who is the state expert on interpreting public information law. And it either is released, and if it's released to the landowner, it's released to everybody, or it's not released if the Attorney General says that it is eligible for trade secret protection. However, the rule and the law both require that all information be released to an emergency responder or a health professional if that health professional or emergency responder asks for the information. There are also, as I mentioned, issues with waste disposal. In Texas, all hydraulic fracturing fluid, flowback, and produced water is either disposed of by injection under our Class 2, our Underground Injection Control Program, which is a federally delegated program, or it's recycled. There were some issues in the Barnett Shale play. We had a few issues with some high-volume disposal wells. There are a lot of issues when you try to cram a lot of water into one small, relatively small hole casing in a short period of time, and we have amended our procedures and our policies for issuance of permits for high-volume disposal wells in certain areas, for example, the Barnett Shale. And we've imposed some limits in other areas where there were potentially problems. We do try to monitor these and require operators to monitor so that we hopefully can catch issues before problems happen. We don't always do that. Science is not perfect. And the issue with water, which is what I'm assuming is a huge issue in the state of Texas, particularly with the issue of the exceptional drought having covered, 90%, more than 90% of the state over the past year. The operator of an average horizontal well, and these horizontal legs can go out several thousands of feet. I mean, it's amazing science that they can go down 1 or 2 miles and then turn a corner and then go out several thousand feet. Who would have thunk it? It's just flabbergast me. But each one of these horizontal wells can use 4 to 6 million gallons of water, and that's a lot of water. Actually, the Mississippi River flows enough water every few hours to hydraulically fracture all the wells in the U.S., but that's still an awful lot of water, awful lot of water. There was a study done by the Texas Water Development Board, and it's actually a contract through the Bureau of Economic Geology at the university in Austin, that basically shows that shale gas used around 1 to 1.5% of all the local water in the Barnett Shale, for example. When you compare that to other uses in that area, you have 3.7 for other industrial or mining, 6.3 for irrigation, and over 80% for domestic use. Now, these are numbers from the Water Development Board, and I understand that they don't quite jive with the comptroller numbers, so I'm not sure how those are being calculated. But even though, for example, in the Barnett Shale, only 1% of the total water use went for gas shale production, when you look at a localized area, for example, Wise County, when the high point in drilling in Wise County was in Wise County, they used potentially up to 10% of the total water that was used in Wise County. So you can have, although it's not a whole lot in a large area, you can have local impacts. So that's something that needs to be taken a look at. I might mention that the Railroad Commission has no statutory authority to prohibit or to limit the use of fresh water, either surface water or groundwater. But we are currently reviewing our recycling rules to eliminate roadblocks and hopefully encourage people to use, not only recycle this flowback fluid or produced water, but also to use lesser quality water in the first place. Deeper waters generally are more saline the deeper you go. So we are trying to encourage operators to go deeper to get the more saline water that is not really a potential source of drinking water for these hydraulic fractures. One other thing that I did want to mention is that we are taking a look at our casing and cementing rules. We have had those rules in place and have strengthened those rules since 1919. You mentioned that we've had those in place for decades. I don't know how many of you know that the Railroad Commission adopted the requirement for casing in an oil and gas well in 1919, not to protect the groundwater, but to protect the oil from that nasty water that was getting into it. So, but it works the same way. It ends up working the opposite way. But we are taking a look at the rules where we think we need to, where we've noticed that there are problems in Texas, not in other states, but in Texas. And we're trying to tweak those to make sure that we don't have any issues in the future. I do appreciate you having me here, and I hope I didn't go over my time.
Thank you. Good evening. My name is Cyrus Reed. I work for the Lone Star chapter of the Sierra Club in Austin. 3-4 years ago, we didn't talk about hydraulic fracturing really as a major issue for Sierra Club. Most of Sierra Club is the oldest and largest conservation organization in the U.S., and frankly, most of our focus has been on coal mining, the use of coal, the dirty emissions from coal, and so our focus has been, let's roll beyond coal. Let's focus on stopping new coal plants and shutting down the oldest and dirtiest coal plants. And gas, 3 or 4 years ago, we saw gas as the bridge fuel, the fuel that was going to get us, you know, from today's energy uses to as prices for solar wind came down, as that technology improved. It was kind of the bridge that we would use to get there. That's really changed over the last 3 or 4 years. I grew up in Syracuse, New York. I've been here in Texas about 20 years, and I was surprised when I went to visit my mom, and I was driving up the road from Binghamton to Syracuse, and there were a whole bunch of signs that said, no fracking in New York. You know, I didn't think of New York as a gas state, but this new technology has opened up gas in places where they haven't been used to drilling. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the concerns and the reason that we no longer talk about natural gas as the bridge fuel. Now we talk about the natural gas reform campaign, which is really about increasing the regulations on the production of natural gas, because we do have a lot of concerns about the way it's produced. One thing I would mention is the natural gas industry, the extraction industry, has been exempted from a number of the federal regulations that cover other industries. So you may have heard back in 2005 as part of the Energy Policy Act, there was something that is sometimes referred to as the Halliburton exemption, which was basically exempting those chemicals being used in the fracturing practice from the Safe Drinking Water Act, sort of the reporting requirements, making sure that it didn't impact water. Hydrogen sulfide, which of course is not just from hydraulic fracturing, but from other natural gas processes, it used to be that the Clean Air Act dealt with hydrogen sulfide. That was exempted. Now there's talk about putting it back in. RCRA, the resource, can't remember what that stands for, Resource Conservation Recovery Act, oil and gas waste were not considered hazardous under RCRA. Clean Water Act, some of those stormwater requirements for looking at stormwater off-site, didn't apply to oil and gas facilities. So I think as Sierra Club and others looked at these practices, they said, well, wait a minute, a lot of the regulations that are covering other industries don't seem to be covering the natural gas industry and in particular the hydraulic fracturing process. So I was going to talk a little bit about why we think there's some additional safeguards that are needed and why at the moment the concept of clean natural gas is really a misnomer until we fix some of these issues. It's been mentioned here a lot in Texas, whether you think of it as a blessing or a curse, we do have the opportunity to hydraulic fracture a whole lot of natural gas and oil. There's not only the Eagle Ford and the Barnett Shale in Haynesville, there's also some areas in West Texas in the Permian Basin and the Woodford that can be, try not to use the word frack. Every time I use the word frack, I can't, you know, I'm giving my age now. I can't help but think about that was the word they used in Battlestar Galactica so they could swear on TV, right? So, but there are a lot of areas. I mean, the reason it really rose to prominence in Texas is because it was used so widely in the Barnett Shale. And why all the attention? Because the drilling, frankly, was a lot closer to people than it had been in the past in Texas. In Texas, we think about, you know, if you think about the movie Giant, you know, it's out in the middle of nowhere. There aren't people living around it. Or maybe just a few ranchers. Suddenly, in the Barnett, you've got a whole lot of people living very close to where the drilling's happening. Before I get to some of the water concerns, you know, a lot of the concerns for Sierra Club, frankly, were about air pollution, and particularly in these areas that were near people. The fact that oil and gas facilities, so not just the not really the fracturing process itself, not really the drilling, but all the stuff that happens with the processing and the compressors and the tanks and the engines, all of that produces air pollution, which can not only lead to ground-level ozone problems that we have here in the summer in Texas, like in Houston and Dallas, but also toxic air pollutants like benzene that can be found right there at the ground where people are living, the particulate pollution. And then kind of something that was of special concern to Sierra Club is just all the methane that can be flared or vented. You know, methane is a climate-changing gas that's very, very powerful. In fact, more powerful than carbon dioxide, although it doesn't last as long in the atmosphere. And what we were finding in the studies was, well, natural gas used in a power plant is a heck of a lot cleaner than coal. If you look at the total process, and particularly if you look at operators who are doing a lot of flaring and venting, it's kind of a wash because while you're producing all this natural gas, if you're venting a lot of methane, you're actually helping cook the planet, right? So we were saying natural gas is a good thing. At the same time, the process, we're looking at the process and saying, well, maybe it's not such a good thing. And what you find in Texas, particularly in the Eagle Ford, is because we don't have all those pipes down there, the pipelines, a lot of times producers, if they don't have the equipment right there to catch the gas, they may have to do a lot of flaring and venting, which means a lot of methane goes into the atmosphere. So that's a particular concern as well. The other thing with methane is, if you really think about it, if you flare and vent natural gas, you're basically losing a product. So if we had better regulation and required things like green completions, where you have to do vapor recovery, we'd actually be recovering the product and not losing it to the atmosphere, not polluting. So that would be a good thing. So we see that as an area where we could work with the Railroad Commission the Railroad Commission has regulations, permits that allow people to flare and vent. And it could be, just as we need to look at the casing rules, we need to look at those flaring and vent rules again these many decades later. Let me get specifically to water. Hydraulic fracturing does use a whole lot of water. As she said, in Barnett Shell, we were looking at 4 to 6 million gallons of water for each frack job. It's actually been a little bit higher than that in the Eagle Ford just because of the different kind of shells they have down there. There is a drought, or there has been a drought, and that means if we were in a time of plenty, if there were plenty of water, people are less concerned. But in a time of drought where municipalities and industries and agriculture are having to curtail, it kind of doesn't sit well with a lot of folks if there's a lot of oil and gas production and they're not having to curtail their use of water. So even though it's a small percentage overall of our water use, in a time of drought, people are saying, well, is this really a good use of water? In Texas, as you know, there are really no limits on the water used in terms of groundwater. You know, groundwater is basically an individual property right in Texas. So there are really no limits to its use other than the resource itself. Is there enough to use it? And we know in Texas that the oil and gas, there really aren't rules other than the recent disclosure rule. There aren't rules in terms of water use reporting. So one of the reasons that there's a lot of unknowns between the comptroller and the Water Development Board and the special study that was done by the YouTube Bureau of Economic Geology is because we don't have required water use reporting by the oil and gas industry. So a lot of it is guesswork. I think the new disclosure law eventually will help that, but we're not there yet. And I'm going to agree with my colleague from the Railroad Commission that we don't have documented cases. We can't prove right now in Texas that hydraulic fracturing itself led to groundwater contamination. But as she said, in the whole process, there have been problems. There have been, you know, I went to their website just a few days ago and looked at all the blowout and well control problems, which aren't necessarily directly related to hydraulic fracturing, but there are problems. There are cases where, okay, in Reeves County, casing parted during frack job, which caused the wellhead to separate from the well. After perforating at 3850 feet and pulling out of the hole with the perforating gun, the surface, the well blew out. So not really the hydraulic fracturing itself, but part of that process led to problems and led to contamination, and in some cases it's led to injuries and deaths. So there are problems. Another issue is, in 2007, the Texas legislature told all the groundwater districts of the state, we want you to get together in regions and plan your groundwater use and look at your future, your what's called your desired future conditions. What do you want your future to look like? And the groundwater district said, fine, we're going to do this. And then hydraulic fracturing started to happen. And a lot of the groundwater districts, not having the real knowledge of how much water is being used and whether this practice is going to continue for decades, they're having a hard time coming, looking at what their groundwater desired future conditions are and how to incorporate it into that planning process. So I think there are a lot of issues. As Leslie mentioned, the YouTube Bureau of Economic Geology did a study in 2001, and as she stated, it was a very small percentage of water use in Texas, but they said it's going to increase. So they were guesstimating that in 2010 it was about 150,000 acre feet, but they were thinking by 2020 it would essentially double in over the 10-year period. So maybe from 1 to 2%, and then as Leslie mentioned, in particular areas, they were looking at a major expansion in use. And so probably the one that has the largest expansion is in the Eagle Ford in South Texas, which is subject to drought. So they said in 2008, it was only about 70 acre feet because there were only one or two wells being fracking at that time. They were saying in 2020 it was going to go up to about 45,000 acre feet. Still a small percentage overall if you think about all the big agricultural farms and booming populations down in the lower Rio Grande Valley. That's a small percentage. It's 4 or 5% of the water use. But in a drought situation, it's of concern. The other thing we may not think about in terms of the impacts are, it's not just the impact on the water use, it's also an impact on the electrical grid. down in South Texas. So you've got a number of electric cooperatives down there. Just are you guys in Pedernales? Are you, is Kerrville its own electric co-op? Are you part of? I'm not sure. You may be. I'm not sure. But down
UGR.
Okay. So down in the valley, they have the South Texas Electric Co-op, which is composed of smaller regional co-ops. You had, I sit on ERCOT, our Electrical Grid Planning Committee, so we look at these transmission lines. They're looking at their load forecast, and some of these electric co-ops like Jackson, Carnes, Medina Electric Co-op, going up just because of the pumping of the water, the electric generators, they're looking at it basically doubling over these next 5 years. And we as a state are having to build new transmission lines just to deal with all of this hydraulic fracturing. So what would we like to see? What would Sierra Club like to see? Well, we'd like to see, obviously, the implementation of this of the chemical disclosure law, which is happening. And that's a good first step. But we really think we need better water reporting between the producers, the Railroad Commission, the Water Development Board, so we can better plan for these water uses. It could be, and some people have said, we actually need to give the authority to groundwater districts to be able to, well, actually require them to permit water use by oil and gas producers. Presently, they're exempt, although an individual groundwater district could impose some limits, but there's really an exemption in our law right now for groundwater use by oil and gas facilities. Maybe we need to apply the same rules that we apply to agricultural water users or others to oil and gas facilities. There may be additional permits we need for certain kinds of oil field fluids and waste disposal, and a big concern for the legislature, and it didn't lead to any passage, but was on saltwater disposal and the regulation of the pipelines which carry the saltwater around. Because the Railroad Commission has full authority, if you're piping saltwater, they have full authority to do something if it breaks and there's a problem, but they don't really have the authority to actually cite where they go. And people are very concerned when there are pipelines with saltwater going across their property, getting rid of this fracking fluid and produced water. One good piece of news is the Railroad Commission is going to once again go through sunset. They tried last legislative session. Sunset is the process where the legislature looks at an agency and tries to think of efficiencies or ways to improve it. So this is an excellent time for we, the public, if we think there's a need for additional regulations, to talk to our legislature and try to get better regulations to deal with some of these issues. So I think I probably should sum up. I'm not sure where I am in terms of time. We're mining an important resource, which is water, to get another important resource, which is natural gas. And so what I think we really need to do is better regulate that process and make sure that in localized areas like the Eagle Ford or the Permian Basin, we don't impact folks too much. And we do need additional regulation on water use reporting, enforcement, proper funding of Railroad Commission. All those things are issues that we need to deal with, because if we're going to continue to use this resource and more people are going to be impacted by this hydraulic fracturing, particularly as it goes closer to populations, you're going to have better regulation of it because there will be problems just like there are in anything. At the federal level, Sierra Club is also dealing with these issues, so we're working. EPA does have some proposed regulations, really for the first time, on oil and gas facilities in terms of their toxics emissions. There's a lot of pushback from industry, but we're hoping those rules go into place soon. There are new rules for, they're coming up with new rules for the use of using diesel fuels in the fracking procedures. They're coming up with policies for public lands on when and where you can hydraulically fracture on those public lands. So those are all good steps they're taking at the federal level, and we need to do the same in Texas. And so not surprisingly, Sierra Club is saying we need more regulation.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much to all three of our panelists. I think that what they've had to say illustrates how significant a topic this is and also how complex a one it is. We've learned, if I may just briefly sum up, that we're talking here in many ways about an old technology, but one that has been put to new uses in new places under the ground, and the volume of the use is one of the major changes from the kind of hydraulic fracturing that occurred in the past. It is indeed a technology with great economic potential to it, and so it's something that we are going to be dealing with. It's not something that's a passing fancy. We have been told, we've learned that the great burst of attention to hydraulic fracturing in Texas is something that has come at a time that has been particularly challenging, a combination of drought, a combination of cuts in the state budget, and a variety of other retirements of specialists in the area of regulation. So particularly challenging. And so there are regulation issues that have not been fully explored, but certainly have been suggested by those who are looking into the matters. So a lot's going on here. We want to do some questions and answers here. I'm going to start off with one. And since Leslie mentioned this, I'm going to point this to her in particular. One of the concerns about water, again, is the freshwater. We say low percentage of the actual water use total, although higher in some areas. But still, there was that question raised about lower quality water, brine, salt water. And is there a potential to answer one of the questions about the fear of using good drinking water that could lie in that, an answer of which could lie in that matter of saying, let's use water that would not be drinkable for this kind of injection?
Actually, yes, I think that there is. I had, when the water issue became such a big issue during the drought, earlier droughts, not last year's drought, I asked the question to several people, why can you not use a lesser quality water, a brine, a slightly saline or saline water or a brine from deeper below the usable, potentially usable quality water? And what I was told is that the companies were concerned about how the chemicals in that saline or slightly saline or brine water would react and what impact that would have on this well that they just drilled and spent several millions of dollars on. From what I understand, and I'm hearing more and more of this, is that because water has become such a huge issue, and it's not only a PR issue, but it's an availability and storage issue, that the companies are doing what they probably should have done a couple of years ago, and they're doing the chemistry and the science to determine, can we use this lesser quality water? What do we have to do to it? Do we have to treat it? Do we have to use maybe different types of additives? They're looking into the science of using this lesser quality water instead of the fresh water. And as usual, it's the bigger companies with the money that are doing the research. But hopefully once they get that researched, finalized, and fine-tuned to the point where they can, in most or many instances, use this lesser quality water, then hopefully that technology will expand and everybody will start using it. Part of it is a matter of economics. It is more expensive to treat a water. It's more expensive to drill deeper for the more saline water. In an area, for example, like the Eagle Ford, where you're producing oil and everybody knows that the price of oil is high and going higher, the economics are there. For the shale gas, they're either not drilling now, have slowed their drilling down. But in those cases where, for example, they have to drill to hold the lease, for example, the economics may not be there for them to use something other than fresh water. But hopefully, that's a long answer to a short question, but okay. Hopefully... that answers it.
Good. Thank you. Now, yes, sir. Question, and I'll repeat it into the microphone here. Yes, ma'am. Well, the question is, and coming as a parent in particular in growing population areas, what is being done about issues related from pipelines to transporting these materials, chemicals, I'm assuming, all of that kind of thing? And whoever is the best person to respond to these, or are multiple people responding, is fine with the panel.
I wish I had easy answers for you. I mean, a lot of the concern with fracking the Barnett Shale wasn't even about the drilling or the compressor engines or the condensate tanks. A lot of it was about the trucks, right? All the truck traffic that was suddenly coming into these areas that didn't have a lot of traffic, and all the diesel emissions and dust that was associated with that. And part of the issue is the Railroad Commission, I don't think, really has the authority to do anything about truck traffic. I think, it's kind of like a new issue has come up and we don't have the regulatory framework in place to deal with it. So it could be that we need to work with TCEQ, Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, particularly in urban areas as part of their state implementation plans on what are the rules going to be for truck traffic. Part of the answer is these new EPA regulations, if they go in place, would basically require oil and gas facilities to be about 90% cleaner, all those facilities were doing the exploration. So that would really cut down on, I mean, there have been a lot of concerns in Barnett Shale with oil and gas facilities located right next to schools, for example, and the effect that has on kids because they're breathing in that benzene right there. So I think, I hate to, I sound like a broken record, but it's really better regulation and enforcement and inspection.
I guess I just want to mention most of the issues that you mentioned, the Railroad Commission doesn't have any jurisdiction over those. And in fact, we don't no longer, as of 2005, have jurisdiction over railroads, but they haven't changed our name. So I would suggest, and this is there, as I mentioned before, there are interim hearings that three of the House committees are going to hold across the state. And that is the House Committee on Natural Resources, the Committee on Energy Resources, and the House Business and Industry Committee. And I would say the concerns that you have, you might want to get online and find out where and when they're going to meet and see if you can't send someone or go yourself and make your concerns known.
Okay, thank you. Another question. Yes, sir. Okay, the question again is the amount of water used in hydraulic fracturing. Can you compare that in some way with the amount of water required to produce a barrel of oil, other kinds of activities?
No. At this point, no, I'm sorry. I should be able to answer that. It's going to vary depending on if it's gas or crude oil. If it's an oil well, how much gas that well produces also, because they don't always just produce crude oil. What formation it's in. What play it's in, what part of the formation it's in, if it's in the core of the play or on the outer edges. So it's going to vary quite a bit. Do we have a total acre feet used in the Barnett Shale?
The estimated use was 25,000 acre feet in 2008. What is it, 300 and something, 300,000 something gallons.
Yeah, gallons.
And then you would have to look at what was the,
figure
it out.
I have that. Actually, I have that information. I have that information, and it compares water use to produce crude oil, water use to produce natural gas, and this is going to be an average, obviously, because they do range so much, water use to produce coal, and water use to produce biofuels. I have kind of that comparison there. And the comparison that I've looked at, and granted, it was not a university that did it. It was a company that produces gas, natural gas. So I have to disclose that. But the comparisons, the numbers that company took from were from the Department of Energy. And I don't know if you think that's a better source or not, but anyway, it was from a federal agency. So those numbers came from a federal agency, and the amount of water used to produce natural gas, given the energy, the equivalent energy of all of those, it was the most water efficient. According to that, to those DOE numbers put into that context. So I can figure that out for you and get the information to you.
But I'm more concerned about the volume of water.
Sorry.
So the question would be, is there potential for the Railroad Commission working with the Texas Water Development Board or some other entity to regulate the amount of water used in particular parts of the state, as it is with agriculture?
Well, actually, domestic use is exempt to a certain extent. The oil and gas, the wells that are drilled by oil and gas operators are not completely exempt from the requirements of Chapter 36 of the Water Code, which is where the groundwater conservation districts get their authority. They're required for a rig supply well to drill and case the well properly. It has to be drilled on the lease where the water is going to be used. There are certain restrictions. In the case of these, generally what they're doing is they're drilling one well and using it for several different ones. So it might not quite fit that category. They are required to register that well with the Groundwater Conservation District. And from what I understand, some of the Groundwater Conservation Districts, in fact quite a few, are interpreting the Chapter 36, 36.117, to require that the oil and gas operators report how much water they're using. So from what I understand, there is more than a potential. It's being done in quite a few places. But I fully expect, and I don't know about you, because of this exceptional drought that we've had, that water is going to be a huge issue, not only in these interim hearings that they're going to have over the summer, but also during the next legislative session. And each legislative session, at least that in 28 years that I've been part of and kind of followed, those exemptions on groundwater use for domestic and for ag and for oil and gas and for, there's actually some for surface mining too, and for uranium mining, mm-hmm. which we also regulate, are tightening. So they're getting, they're tightening in the favor of the groundwater conservation district control. So my opinion is there is potential, and it is happening. It may not be happening fast enough, you know, but it is happening.
See if we have some other questions here.
Well, I wanted to make one other point with that, is that
surely,
the simple differentiation from the groundwater conservation district idea for wells of different types is that the oil and gas production support wells were seen as temporary, mm-hmm. and whereas they were primarily regulating permanent wells of large volume, such as municipalities, mm-hmm. or irrigators or industries might use. That simplification probably is too simple now.
It is.
Okay.
And just to be clear, the Water Development Board did not really look at the water use for fracking in their Texas State Water Plan, but they say that for the 2016 plan, they will try to incorporate that information. So it is moving in that direction.
Okay. And that's why they did the special studies in the Barnett Shale and then statewide.
All right, over here, yes?
Okay.
The question is why this industry is not regulated on federal and state level.
Show me an industry that doesn't have a good subsidy or a good exemption. I'll show an industry that hasn't hired good lobbyists. I mean, right? I mean, that's the simple fact, is if you look at these regulations, a lot of them, someone, just as Sierra Club does, someone fought and lobbied to get an exemption in the law. Now, in some cases, I think, as you mentioned, it's because, you know, there's a particular issue, like the water is used on a temporary basis, so they felt it should be treated differently. But I think in a lot of the cases, it's just they were successful in lobbying to be exempted.
Okay. I actually disagree with you that they're not regulated. The Railroad Commission has regulated them since 1919. It may not have been as strong regulation in the past, and I'll tell you that prior to 1969, pretty much they did anything they wanted to. But after 1969, you can see, and actually before EPA started regulating anything, you can see that the states, and Texas in particular, and Oklahoma and some of the larger producing states, actually did have relatively strong regulations on the books, and I can tell you at least through my 28 years that they have gotten much stronger and they will get more stronger still. On the federal level, I cannot answer you. I can't answer for them. I can give you my opinion, and my opinion is that oil and gas historically has been considered a national security issue, a domestic security issue, an economic security issue, and therefore an issue that a lot of people felt needed to be protected. And again, you know, Cyrus' answer probably is just as valid. But from that standpoint, I think that it was considered to be a security issue on a number of various levels. And so that's why there have been some exemptions that have been placed through. And they are very active in the science of this. Some of the arguments are that they've made, and actually the states have made for state regulation as opposed to federal regulation, are based on science, and I think were very strong arguments. And that's why I didn't wear red today.
Ken, your thoughts?
Sure. I'll just briefly say one of the things I've done on the side is environmental consulting, both with oil companies and producers and with landowners when there have been contamination problems associated with stuff that got away out in the oil field. And in general, the Railroad Commission does have a rule, number 8, that groundwater is supposed to be protected. You're not supposed to do any, it's not supposed to be any different when you leave than it was when you got there. And it's just one rule. It's one page.
But
it means, it means a lot more. And that was exactly where I was going, is that, you know, the TCEQ has a lot of rules for water. The Railroad Commission had less, but the Railroad Commission is growing because of that separation. And please do use the avenues that Leslie's been talking about to let the people who make the decisions about how these agencies work and how they're funded. Not only we've had a real problem in Texas of making regulations but not providing enough resources to the people that can enforce them or interpret them or write them in English. So I really want to encourage you as the public. You are the ones that elect the people that make those decisions. And when it's something you care about, you can make the difference. So please pass that on.
Yes, sir. Recycling water issues and efforts.
As I mentioned before, thank you for that question. As I mentioned before, we don't have any statutory authority to restrict the use of fresh water. At this point, all we can do is try to provide for encouragement to recycle the water. And one of the things that our commissioners have directed staff to do is a couple of years ago, we adopted some regulations that are, I got to write them, so they're a whole lot more than a couple of pages long, on recycling, commercial recycling. Our commissioners have said that rule has not grown with the water recycling issue, and so they've asked us to take a look at that issue as well. That rule deals with commercial recycling, but we're also looking at ways that we can remove roadblocks from individual operators and their contractors recycling water. I will mention that there was a bill that was introduced, and I think it was passed a couple of years ago, that gave oil and gas operators a tax exemption on equipment that was used in the recycling of fracture flowback and produced water and other pollution prevention equipment. And so those are kind of incentives to hopefully get people to do the right thing,
Okay. Basically.
But that's where we are right now. And it's on our webpage for informal comment. Be happy if you would comment.
I just want to encourage people. I appreciate the mentioning of the hydrologic cycle, because water moves at different speeds through different parts of it. The atmosphere, it's real fast. Surface water, relatively fast. Groundwater, really slow. Subsurface water next to oil and gas, even slower. So what we remove from certain places can be replaced quickly. Some places it can't. So and that does connect also with the recycling issue. I know there are interests already being pursued in some places where people are going to use treated wastewater effluent for the fracking waters, and I'm really hoping that's going to be an answer for a lot of places to help with that. Now, in some cases, that might, if it's a place where that treated wastewater effluent would go into a river that someone else would use downstream, there might be a challenge to that. But in a lot of the oil patch, we're talking places where the wastewater is not a treated wastewater effluent. Got to make sure I say that. Treated wastewater effluent is not discharged into a surface water body. So there, you know, depending on where you are, there are different opportunities for hopefully better choices.
Up front here.
So the question is about understanding.
Why don't we talk about the term and the use, the terminal use of water at one time, and rather than repeated or continuous use?
Has anybody here played Jenga? Do you know what Jenga is? Or dominoes? You know, set the dominoes up. That's kind of the way this is. For example, the example that you were using about using treated effluent in hydraulic fracturing, but then you've taken that water out of the surface water. So you have to be very careful what tweaks you make on both sides, on oil and gas, because we do whatever anybody says we do right now need oil and gas, and water. We all need the water. One of the issues is that some of these wells can be refract. So it's not just a one-time deal. It could be two or three times. Although this tends to be, at least in my experience, years, you know, years apart. The problem is that all this drilling is coming and putting pressure on our water resources during an exceptional drought. And so, you know, you've just pretty much exploded the Jenga. You just kicked it, you know. If we didn't have an exceptional drought and we were not in such a tizzy about where our water is going to come from in 50 years, it might not be that big an issue. But right now, it is an issue for a lot of people. We're doing water planning. What's not considered in the water planning. I wasn't going to mention, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about a study that said that basically the burning of the methane from the natural gas will also produce water. And there is a study that says that the water from that balances out the water that you've used. The only problem is you use the water over here, and the water was generated over here during the burning. So it's not quite it's not quite equal. I don't know a good answer to your question. When you look at the Texas Water Code, the very first part of it talks about benefits. Water has to be used for a benefit. And there's a whole long list of beneficial uses. And one of those is oil and gas. And none of them are prioritized. So those are kind of the Jenga blocks. You've got to make sure that you don't pull one out to the detriment of the other and vice versa. So it's kind of a balancing act, and I don't know if that answers your question or not.
I'm going to take one. I'm sorry.
And just the other issue would be, if you take water that could be used for drinking and you mess it up such that it can't be used again, you're kind of taking it out of the hydrological cycle. I mean, not totally, but you're taking water that was usable and making it unusable versus if it goes into a drinking water system, goes into a wastewater treatment plant, it's going to be used again. So that, you know, that's another issue.
Okay. I'm going to take one more question over here, and then I'll let you make your comment because you were up front there. And then our panelists will remain here and chat and be happy for you to come talk with them too. Yes, sir.
So the question is, don't we seem to be in a reactive mode to the conditions that occur? And if so, how do we become more proactive in dealing with issues?
And remember, panelists, we are prepared to explore every angle and every question.
I guess maybe I'm a member of a national organization called the Groundwater Protection Council, and it's made up of the state water agency representatives, not just oil and gas, but also other like Water Development Board, similar to TCEQ. They're water agencies. And we just recently reorganized a couple of years ago, and one of the divisions that we reorganized that I chair is the energy water. It's energy for water and water for energy. And basically, it's not only water being used to generate energy, but energy is also needed to generate water. You have to transport it, you have to treat it, you have to produce it. So both are intertwined, as you mentioned. They're intertwined like this. We need both of them, and they're dependent on each other. I do not know what we can do at this point, and I'm hoping that the legislature will come up with answers this next session. I do not know what we can do to get ahead of it. As part of a national group that does it's a stakeholder group that reviews state environmental regulations for oil and gas in other states. You have one environmental representative, one industry and representative, and one state agency representative. We go into a state and look at their environmental regulations. I happen to be on the review team for the state of North Carolina. And it might amaze you to know that North Carolina actually has two wells two oil wells. They're not producing. They haven't produced in a long time. But they have a small corner of their state where the Marcellus is. And they are in a unique position. Their legislature told, I guess, our equivalent agency, it's a combination of TCEQ and Railroad Commission equivalent agency, to go out and study, number one, whether or not the resources in that small little corner of Marcellus is going to be worth doing anything about, number one. And number two, if it is, what kind of regulations do we need to have in place? They are in an enviable position. They get to start from scratch. We're kind of either at the tail end of it or running, you know, running behind it. I don't know how to answer that question. All I know is that people are starting to think about energy and water as being intertwined and thinking about them together. There was a couple of months ago, I can't remember what group did it, but it was in Texas, that talked about energy needs in the future and water needs associated with that. So people that can make things happen in the state of Texas are starting to think about both of those things and the nexus that there is. And that was another long answer to a short question. I apologize.
Either of other panelists want to comment on that?
We're, of course, very interested in this very topic. Sierra Club is helping sponsor a conference on April 27th at the AT&T Center in Austin. You can go on the Lone Star Chapter website. That's really focused on water conservation, but about how do we use water more wisely into the future. So it's using water more wisely and using energy more wisely. There are things, you know, right now the state of Texas is looking at our building codes. How do we build, when we build a new building, what code does it have to be built to? Because people use energy, but it's people living in buildings that use energy. So if you make the buildings more efficient, you're going to use energy more wisely. So there's not a single answer, right? It's a whole series of things. This could go on for many hours to come up with all the answers.
Well, one mechanism the state does have, and I need to say this because I'm on the regional planning board, is that was what the regional planning process was supposed to do when it was started in 97, was to help bring the different concerns that connect to water together. Now, when it was born, and it's still its main interest, is making sure urban areas have enough water for their growth, as you mentioned a while ago, because that's the most voters, I guess, is what I would say. But the reality is it also is a chance for all the different water user groups, they're called WUGs, it's a wonderful term, to have their information shared and reviewed. The challenge has been mentioned because it's a regional planning process. It's on a five-year cycle. We just finished one. The 2012 water plan was started in 2007, you know, in terms of putting it together, and now we're working toward the next one. Every time we've done this, there's always been something new in some part of the state. And so I don't know what is there an agency in the state with a crystal ball? Okay. But the reality is, though, we need to ask those questions and use these abilities. And, again, it is part of – I'm a state employee, so this probably sounds like I'm asking for stuff I need, too. But, again, if we expect the state government and federal government to deal with these things, we need to make sure that we tell them it is worth it to invest the time and people and funds to deal with those issues, because, you know, no single entity on their own, no single industry or single municipality or single lobbyist, you know, can represent all the pieces alone. So I'm not saying the process is perfect. We're trying to make it better, but that's an example. So the idea is there, and I think it's the more interest that is you get to influence this in your own communities, right? In your own cities, about how water is used and what you pay for it, where does it come from, am I going to water my yard, you know, those kind of issues. But then also in terms of the people who need your vote to run the state, right now they think everybody just wants all the taxes cut. Is that really all we want? You know, if we have other concerns, we need to think about those priorities as well. And we may need to educate the media along the way, too.
That's an excellent composite response there, really, to a very, very complex but very, very important question. The comment, sir, you wanted to make.
My name is Pete Mish. I've got a BS, MS, and a PhD in petroleum engineering. And I just wanted to make a few comments. I think that the majority of the problems that you've read about of groundwater contamination that have been associated with fracking, that 100% of them have probably been caused by the disposal of the produced water that has came back. Now, on the soil formations, a large percent of the water that is pumped into those formations is probably going to come back with the oil or gas as it's being produced. It will diminish fairly rapidly as a function of time. The chemicals that are used in these fracks from the various companies, I don't think any of those are very important to anyone unless they've got some contamination. And at that point, they certainly need to know what kind of chemicals did this company put in. So the Railroad Commission, you know, needs to keep all of those. I don't think the general public has any benefit from them. It doesn't hurt for them to know, but it isn't going to help them any. If they've got a pollution problem that comes up, then they've got to report it, and something will be, you know, done about it. On the volumes of water that are used in these fracks, it's a function of the length of the well. Many of these wells are drilled on, let's say, a section. Everybody's got the right to go out and develop the resources under their property. But with the shale, almost all of this work is being done by major oil companies or very large independents, because the small independents really probably can't afford this. These wells are $7, $8, $9, $10 million wells. So that's a big budget for a small operator. Most of the big companies I know are probably using all new pipe, and they're doing a good job of monitoring the casing pressure when they're doing the frack. That's the only other way that a frack job could hurt a surface water, is if the casing parts and, you know, during the frack job so that the water would go into the formation. But if they've got a surface casing that has been set below the freshwater sands, they've got inside casing that goes all the way down to, let's say, 7,000 feet in the Eagleford. The freshwater sands are probably cemented off around 2,200, 2,300 feet. They've got that casing annulus full of fluid. They're monitoring the pressure of that annulus as they're pumping into the tubing to do the frack job. So if that casing pressure jumps up, they'll stop that pump right away so that they don't continues to pump into that formation. The volume of water that's used for, let's say, a single section, they've determined over the last few years that the larger volumes of water that they pump into it, the more recovery that they've got. But let's say on a 640-acre section, you drill down 7,000 feet, you kick out about 5,000 foot horizontal, around 12,000, 12,500 foot, you know, a typical volume of water is probably 110,000 barrels. Well, there's 42 gallons to a barrel, so that fits in the range of what's been discussed. Many of the bigger operators that have gone in and leased larger tracts, they're drilling out over two sections maybe, or at least a section and a half. Well, this saves a lot of time because a lot of the work as far as the pollution of drilling, the surface, and everything else that's involved is for each individual well. Well, if they're drilling out 12,000 or 15,000 feet, you know, horizontally, they don't have as much of that. So they're doing this as a function of economics. And as far as the using the water, I don't think there's any of the companies that are going to be going to counties that don't have a lot of water. They're going to be going to places that they can get large volumes of water easily, because that's a very expensive part of their drilling. They've got to get the water, pump it in, get it out, and dispose it. That probably costs them from $3 to $5 a barrel, and if they're drilling 100,000 barrels plus of water, or a quarter million barrels of water, you can see in a hurry how much that water is costing toward this frack job.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I think everybody can agree that we've had some folks who have shed a lot of light on a very complicated topic. The purpose of these events is indeed to do just that. We appreciate those of you who are here, those of you who have asked questions. An enlightened public is a great asset in a democracy. That's an obvious statement, a truism, but one that we dare not forget. So it is a pleasure to conclude this edition of the Texas Water Symposium. We're pleased to be a part of that, and we invite you to have some refreshment, to talk with our panelists here, and otherwise wish you a good evening.